Let's do it.
Boom. There you go. Molly Wood says, let's do it. We do it. That just kind of happened.
Yes,
didn't it?
Oh, we amazing. Do. Turns out, so one thing that happened I may not have told you is I'm in charge now.
What?
Yeah.
Oh, man. Hey, everybody. It's Kyle Rizdahl. This is Making Me Smart, the Tuesday show. That was Molly Wood being in charge. Tech, the economy, culture, all kinds of good stuff. Today, we are talking, holy cow, what is going on with this pandemic, because the woods are something we are not out of yet. And we're going to talk about that with a guy who really knows the answers.
We really are, yeah. And in case you have missed it, huge upticks in case numbers over the past week, particularly in the South and Southeast in some cases. Leaders in some of those states, including actually Maine, so not the South or Southeast, Louisiana and Kansas, are calling for a rollback on reopening plans. And I feel like it's an important time to note that this is not the second wave, you guys. Still the first one. Still the first one. Or apparently at Make Me Smart, we've landed on wave 1.5. I don't know. Anyway, we have invited our favorite doctor, Lauren Wold, back on the show. You may remember he was on in April to talk about testing. Obviously, a lot has changed since then, and we just wanted to get a sense of the landscape with Lauren. Welcome back.
Thanks so much for having me. Great to be back.
All right. We should probably say here, Lauren is a professor and assistant dean for biological health research at Ohio State University, not just our favorite doctor like the kind on TV.
Yeah.
I do really want to want to clarify that. What's going on? Where are the hotspots right now? Help.
Yeah. So that's a loaded question that seems to be changing by the day. So I think, you know, part of the issue is we instituted the traveling bans and restaurant closures and such. And now that things are starting to open back up, we're starting to see the numbers increase. And so, as you said, the West, I know Arizona has been in the news, has had significant increases in cases. LA County, a lot of the larger cities, as people are going somewhat back to their normal lives, going back to work as work is allowing employees back in, and going back out to restaurants and such, we're seeing the cases are starting to increase. But I think it's also important to note that we are also testing more. So we're seeing more because we are testing more.
So what should we look at, right? Because there is number of new cases, there's number of hospitalizations, there's certainly number of deaths. What are your metrics? What do you like?
So I think the important numbers that I'm cautiously optimistic about are the number of patients in ICUs and on ventilators is not at the high levels that we were seeing initially. So that's at least one positive out of this. We are still seeing where the numbers are increases in certain areas and the number of deaths are increasing, but we have seen those numbers decrease. And you know, part of these numbers is they will fluctuate some. So the decline is not always a bell curve where it continues to decline. It will once in a while sort of plateau, increase a little bit before it decreases. So I'm cautiously optimistic mm-hmm. that we may see this, or at least see something that resembles this.
Huh.
And was that, I mean, you know, from your perspective, even the sort of question, as we have seen just in recent days, of, you know, testing more leading to more positives has been somewhat politicized, but does this on some level make sense that there would be more testing, more positive cases, and potentially a case fatality rate that is sort of starting to become clear, or is that still all over the place too?
Yeah, so I think that with the increased testing, we are seeing greater levels.
Mm-hmm.
Therefore, the percent of deaths related to the total number of cases has decreased some because we're testing more. And we're testing more asymptomatic people. So a lot of people are getting tested just out of curiosity. And they're finding out, whoa, I had no symptoms, but now I'm testing positive. Because mm-hmm. many places are offering the tests for those that don't have an order from a physician. They're able to just walk up or drive up and get the test. So I think that our numbers are going to continue to be high as long as we're testing at this level. Now that the test kits are more readily available, there's still some issues, but states have been able to get significantly more tests than they were able to a month ago.
All right, so let me take this sideways. Would you get on an airplane right now?
Great question. I would. I wish I could. Unfortunately, Ohio State has not allowed us to fly, but I probably would with significant measures in place. I would definitely wear a mask. I would, you know, bring wipes to wipe everything down, even though the planes are supposedly clean much more routinely. And I think people are more cautious with flying than they were a month ago. I think that people who are flying now are doing it because it's not for leisure travel, it's more for business travel. So I would with significantly more measures in place.
With some caveats, right?
Exactly.
Well, I mean, I guess that's what I wonder is, are we getting to a point where we are better able to evaluate? Dr. Bob Wachter from UCSF was tweeting the other day about probabilities, you know? Like he was saying, the average American is not good at thinking probabilistically. But at some point that, you know, especially as it's become clear that the country's in a reopen, full stop. And so it's about keeping your own counsel, figuring out what probabilities you're comfortable with, right? Like, do you feel like because of the increase in testing, watching data come in, learning more about the virus, that we're getting to a point where we can maybe more rationally evaluate probabilities?
I think that's absolutely correct. And I think that the unfortunate reality is that there has to become a time when everyone needs to make a decision for themselves of when they're going to start getting back to some sense of what we called normal before. It's not going to be normal until everyone has access to vaccinations that are effective and prevent us from getting the virus. That's a ways out. And so, you know, the issue is, do you start taking the chance, if you will, based on probabilities and start flying, going to restaurants, going to a movie theater, et cetera?
What are you looking for from here on out as we, you know, crest on wave 1.5 and head into 2 or whatever nomenclature people want to use? How are you going to make your probabilistic decisions, I guess, is the question, right? I mean, you're a scientist.
Yeah. So I think it's watching I watch the numbers on a daily basis in Ohio and neighboring states. You know, you can see that whenever there's larger gatherings that, you know, 2 weeks out, that it's likely that those numbers will increase. But I'm cautiously optimistic with the way the data has gone. Ohio, for example, yesterday had 700 new cases, which was almost double what we've had for new cases on a daily basis in the last 2 weeks. I'm hoping that's a blip on the radar. But I think one needs to just to watch these numbers, be careful of their surroundings, maintain the separation from people, wear your protective masks and gloves if you like, and just be smart.
Be smart. Bless. So little of that going around right now. Actually, that's not fair. I sort of feel like the majority of people are, like you said, being careful on some level, are attempting to take care of themselves. What are we learning, though? Like, you know, we've had two arguably pretty significant data points recently. One was the two hairdressers in Missouri who were both sick, not just infected, but sick, and cut the hair of hundreds of customers. But everybody wore masks and nobody contracted it. And then the second data point seems to be that from that big outdoor gathering at Lake of the Ozarks that was so viral, no pun intended, online, that there hasn't been a big outbreak from that. Like, are we getting more data points about, you know, masks and outdoor transmission and things like that?
I think that's part of it, Molly. I think the other case in point, I was just speaking to one of my lab members who just returned from Las Vegas, and they got a call that an employee at the hotel had tested positive, and so they were told, you must self-quarantine. And so I think people are taking the message that when they do find out they may have been exposed to someone, they're taking those measures of self-quarantining and getting tested. Whereas before, I think the message either was not being heard or people weren't taking it as seriously as they are now.
Masks, yes or no?
Yes, absolutely. Yes. I will be honest. In the beginning, I was not personally as good as I should have been, but now I actually wear it all the time.
I mean, it seems like it was an evolving conversation, right? So that's fair. Right. Like, at first we were like, we don't know what to do. And it seems like now we know. And it's just a matter of like the hard yes, everyone.
Exactly. It's like it when traveling to Asia a year ago, everyone wears a mask in Asia. And I think that's going to be our new norm for a while.
All right. So not to put you up against Tony Fauci, as I call him, but he said today on Capitol Hill, he said, you know, it's not a question of if, but when we get a vaccine. And he said, end of the year, maybe beginning of 2021. Do you buy that?
I do.
Really? Wow.
So I know that there's at least one company that's in phase three clinical trials right now. The FDA, the NIH has been extremely cognizant of these trials and is on top of their game, and there's at least 50 to 100 candidates out there now in anywhere from phase one to phase three clinical trials. So I think we're going to have something by at least very early 2021. I'm not sure if it'll be as effective as the one we'll have at the end of 2021, because I think it's going to evolve and there's going to be new candidates. But I'm very optimistic that we're going to have something by the early of 2021. The question is, who's going to be eligible to get it? I think that's going to, unfortunately, become a political thing in the beginning, and we're going to have to work through that.
That was my next question, is like, okay, great, vaccine exists. But as somebody who, you know, recently transitioned his lab into a production facility, you saw that, you know, there were like, literally you couldn't get the tubes to put things in. I mean, how big at producing a vaccine in the scale of billions is non-trivial, right?
Absolutely. It's going to be a Herculean effort. And companies are going to have to work together, which traditionally has not been the norm in biomedical sciences, to get these to get the capacity that we need in order to actually make an effective change.
I heard the tape the other day of Edward R. Murrow talking to Jonas Salk, and Murrow asking Salk who owns the patent, and Salk, of course, saying, I imagine the people own the patent, which be interesting if that's the way this thing played out this time. But I do not believe it will, sadly. Lauren Wald is a physician. He's a professor, assistant dean of biological health research at Ohio State University. A little editorial right there, right at the end there. Come on.
Just sneak in a little downer for us. Problems. Thanks. Thanks.
You know, it's kind of my job. Lauren, thanks a lot. We really appreciate you coming on.
Thank you so much. Have a wonderful day.
Talk to you soon.
Take it easy. Be good. Bye-bye now.
Thanks.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
I'm right, I mean, right? Come on. This is like a multi-bazillion dollar vaccine.
Oh, absolutely. Well, and also, I mean, you know, Lauren, Dr. Wald mentioned that companies are going to have to work together. But here's the thing. So are countries. Like, we have literally already heard that our country may have been attempting to procure exclusive rights. Mm-hmm. Given the state of various relationships, that is not a possibility. I mean, get used to masks, people. Get used to masks. Because I think it's almost a little unfair to say a vaccine will exist in the beginning of 2021.
Right.
Because it's still a years-long process.
People being people are
going to
go, oh, yeah, we're done. Yeah, Americans are going to go, yeah, we're all set. There's a vaccine coming. We're all set. Right?
Yep.
You know.
We are headed into a little break before we go. How are you feeling about this? I mean, I think, most of the sane people that I know are in a similar boat, which is I'm taking basic precautions. I'm nervous. I don't know. You know, the advice continues to feel conflicting. And so we're just wondering how you're feeling. Do you have mask requirements? Are people following them? Are there enough tests? Do you feel safe going to a restaurant or a pool? And do you feel like it's time to open up the economy regardless? Tell us what you're thinking. Record yourself in a voice memo if you don't mind. Otherwise, feel free to email us, makemesmart@marketplace.org, and we'll be right back.
Thank you.
All right, we're back. In that little break there, I decided that I'm aware. I'm not stressed. I'm not nervous. I'm aware of what's going on out there, right? That's exactly it.
Yeah.
Like when I'm out and about, yeah. I'm just aware.
I think that's fair. You know. Yeah, I'm getting real used to the mask thing.
Yeah. Mm. Oh, for sure. Yeah, don't even think about it anymore. And no. Props to my kids who like to put them on when they go out. So, you know, kids are being aware too, which is a plus.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. So we got news. I got one. You got, oh, look, you got two.
I do have two.
Feel free. Have at it.
I'm so sorry. Well, one was just a little update on what we were talking about yesterday, which was that executive order suspending foreign work visas, including the H-1B program for high-skilled workers. And, you know, when the original immigration ban was being proposed, we actually had a conversation on Marketplace Tech with the Consumer Technology Association, which is the big trade group for tech companies. And, you know, they're unequivocal on this topic, which is that, like, not only do moves like this damage the ability of American companies to be economically competitive, it damages the country's ability to be competitive. And it, frankly, hands an advantage to China or Singapore or Canada. And case in point today, Toby Lütke, who's the CEO of Shopify, tweeted, if this affects your plans in some way, this executive order, consider coming to Canada instead. Shopify is hiring all over the world, and we have lots of experience helping with relocation. Just straight up advertising. Come to Canada. By the way, Toronto, already big time tech city. Just throwing that out there.
Oh, is that right? I did not know that. That's something I should have known. Huh.
Toronto's very techy. My son is weirdly obsessed with it. Which is a whole other strange. I'm just like, how do you get obsessed with Toronto? I know. Yeah. Wow. And then my second thing is, like, I'm not trying to throw another giant disaster in the mix, but but if the pandemic is a warm-up act for catastrophic climate change, we definitely need to get on the ball. And I think that, interestingly, it seems to be affecting opinion in that direction. So the Pew Research Center put out the results of a new survey today, Tuesday, that found that nearly two-thirds of Americans now believe the federal government should act more aggressively to combat climate change. This is in the Washington Post. Overwhelmingly think the government needs to do more to reduce greenhouse gases, to create policies that plant huge numbers of trees or restrict emissions, require more fuel-efficient cars, tax corporations based on their emissions. All of the things that the current administration is doing the opposite of. Yeah. To be clear, but people are starting to feel, literally feel, the impact of extreme climate change. It is now arriving, much like the pandemic. It is no longer theoretical, and opinions are changing fast.
Which is a good thing. Let's be clear about this. That is a good thing.
I mean, it is a good thing, although there are unfortunately still some large partisan divides and lots and lots of inactivity. Yep. But on the plus side, I did see that Amazon launched a $2 billion fund today to invest in climate technologies, which I'm going to take I'm going to take some responsibility for. I think that was because of our series on Marketplace Tech, in which we like knocked on the door of all the tech companies and we were like, hey, what are you doing about technology to help with climate change? So many crickets.
Credit where credit is due. There
so many crickets, but they're getting in the game.
Good. They are, which is good. Okay. Mine is, oh, look, it's a little depressing. It's a piece in The Atlantic by Annie Lowry, who's super, super sharp about a bunch of things. And I will just read you a sentence from her piece, the headline of which is The Second Great Depression. And here's what Annie writes. At least four major factors are terrifying economists and weighing on the recovery. The household fiscal cliff, which is the expiration of extended unemployment benefits at the end of July. The great business die-off. When Kimberly was here last week, she pointed out that 41% of black-owned businesses have just vaporized. They just disappeared. And for white-owned businesses, it's like 20 or 22%. So bad. State and local budget shortfall, which are going to be cataclysmic. $54 billion here in the state of California. And then, oh, yeah, the lingering health crisis. So I think it's really interesting that as we open up and everything's fine, even though some cities and counties and states are saying, well, maybe we can't open up so far, you're seeing a lot of people out there without masks and without any of that jazz. There are, it's not good. It's, there's just a lot to be really uptight about. And that's all I'm saying.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's all I'm saying.
No, I mean, it's really true. And it is much like climate change, a thing that we somehow like – cannot seem to want to deal with until it's right in front of us. And yet we know that it's coming.
Yep.
We know.
For sure.
I mean, I would like to also say we know that it's very likely that despite current postures, there will be a second wave of assistance from the federal government because there kind of can't not be.
Yeah.
You know, so I'm hoping that that my general life maxim of nothing is ever as bad or as good as you think it's going to be will hold here.
Oh.
And that even though we're headed for a cliff. Right. You know, it's like, generally speaking, hope springs eternal. Okay. Yep. That's it for the news fix. It is your turn to talk.
Hi, Kai and Molly.
This is Brent in Detroit.
This is Rebecca from Baltimore.
It was great to hear comments on my question about GDPR.
I wanted to put in my vote.
I want to discuss a slightly different but maybe related thing.
Okay, more on defunding the police. Comments are still coming in on that one. The conversation obviously is still going on. The idea has gained a lot of momentum, although officials in 17 U.S. cities have pledged some defunding in one way or another. Most are not going as far as Minneapolis said it's going to go, but it's unclear whether they can go that far. However, the Overton window, Sam Sanders on the show, has moved without a doubt. On this topic. So we got a comment about it from listener Donna Bosgan.
Hi, Make Me Smart. This is Donna from Michigan. The first time I heard the phrase defund the police, I thought, heck yeah. As a middle-aged, middle-class white woman living in a very Caucasian bedroom community, my personal experiences with police are not life-threatening, but they've never been positive either. Because of being very lightly policed, my community has an extremely low crime rate. And despite that, our clearance rate is still less than 50%. Imagine being successful at your job only half the time and still getting to keep it. And for this privilege, the community pays in revenue-enhancing traffic stops, constantly increasing property taxes, and special millages to pay for the cops' pensions. Who else even still is offered a pension? So everyone should consider what they think the police are doing, then find out what they really do, and assess whether that's actually beneficial or if the money could be better spent or saved. Even someone in the Karen demographic like me can support the defund the police and racial justice movements.
There will be people who don't know what the Karen demographic is, Ms. Wood. Why don't you explain that? Because I will surely miss
it. Oh, God. Karen is so fraught. The Karen demographic generally refers to the concept of a 40-ish and up white lady who's incredibly entitled, often wants to call the manager, and is usually the type to call the cops on. That's like the whole, the Karen joke is like, Karen wants to see a manager. Yep. But she's also increasingly been the type to, you know, call the police on black people having a barbecue in the park. You can have a whole other conversation on whether the Karen situation has gotten a little out of hand. But it's a type. It's a type. Yeah. What I find so interesting about the moving of the Overton window here is that there are people who definitely have that visceral reaction that we talked about on the show when we did that episode to the phrase. And yet it literally usually only takes people like 5 minutes of like conversation or reading or even a look at their own city budget. You know, I mean, I was not totally startled to discover that Oakland is basically a police department with a municipality sort of attached to it. To go like, oh, maybe this is in fact fundamentally a line item that doesn't have a good ROI, which I think is what our caller's getting at there.
It's just, you know, the movement needs a better slogan, right? That's the catch. That's the deal.
I will have that argument all day long.
Yeah, for sure. For sure.
It is not our slogan to edit. Let me just put it that way.
Oh no, for sure. For sure.
Also, I think it works.
Do you really?
I do think it works. Like, not only do I think it's academic, let me be clear, because we know from our interview that this has been a slogan in the black community for decades, right? This has been a movement. So it is like nobody's interested in us trying to come in and rephrase to make it nicer for white people.
Not doing that. Nope.
But honestly, I think it works because it immediately gets people's attention. It does move the Overton window quickly and nobody doesn't engage with it. It doesn't like go by all nicety nice, like community reform.
Right. But if what you want to do is build a movement based around this idea of reallocating police resources, right? I would just suggest that as a quick blow-by slogan, which is the way media operates and society operates right now, it leaves a little bit to be desired.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I'm not sure.
All
I
right.
agree.
Okay.
But,
all right.
You know,
well,
yeah.
We tell you what.
In fact, to be clear, I totally don't. But yes, exactly.
Sure.
Tell us what you think.
Right. 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 Make me smart at marketplace.org and we'll get some of them on the pod. So I don't even know what that was. You know what that was? That was my Alexa blipping in and out. Oh, well, I'm going to unplug her now.
Well, hello.
Anyway, I've asked you a couple of times. Molly's asked as well for you guys to tell us how you're doing because it's tough out there. Tougher for some than for others, for sure, with lost jobs and perhaps relatives who have passed. But sometimes, depending on circumstances, there is some good to be had about this. And Joe Wodenchek has a little bit of it.
Good morning, Kai and Molly. This is Joe from Canandaigua, New York. I was furloughed about a month ago, like so many other Americans. It spun me into a bit of a depression. After binge-watching Netflix for 3 weeks, I was able to pull myself out of my funk by working on something that had been in the back of my mind for the last couple of years, a languishing startup idea. I reached out to my partner, started making calls, and got some really positive feedback. Now, we're getting ready to pitch our first potential investors. What's my point? The time off, coupled with just enough cash flow to prevent a panic attack, allowed me to pursue something that inspires me. How many other people across our country are doing something similar? I have faith and hope in America, and I think that there are others like myself that are working on inventions in their garages or working on that business concept that's been put off for far too long. Could we find a hidden benefit of the reset and the forced time off or working from home conditions we find ourselves in, the impetus for a new American entrepreneurial renaissance? Keep up the great work, and thank you.
Amen.
I love that.
Amen to that.
Yep.
Amen
Absolutely
to that.
Love that.
I have not done all my pandemic promised skills development that I wanted, but look, Joe, awesome. Truly, truly awesome. I think that's great.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of people have, and it is remarkable. And I totally, yep. I mean, there's an old maxim in Silicon Valley that some of the best companies are built in, you know, in down times.
Yeah.
So keep at it. That's awesome. And also keep us posted. Like if you get investment, will you write back? Write back.
Yeah,
sure. All right, before we go, the Make Me Smart question. What is something you thought you knew, but you later found out you were wrong about? This week's entry comes from Gary Tsai. He's a psychiatrist and medical director of substance abuse programs for Los Angeles County, also a filmmaker. And he called in on the subject of the American healthcare system. Here's his answer.
I grew up with a mother with schizophrenia. I remember being confused about why it was so hard to get her help. I always thought that my family's challenges were because we needed more. More doctors, more programs, more hospitals, or more money for all of those things. More is often a response to our biggest problems in healthcare. We get a new grant and start a new program. A legislator writes a bill that brings in new funding, and we can build a new clinic or hospital. After going to medical school and becoming a healthcare administrator, I realized that while more is often helpful, there comes a point where the benefits of more are counterbalanced by the drawbacks of the complexity that comes with more. Mm-hmm. And that, in fact, this complexity is one of the main reasons people are unable to access healthcare today. Our systems are far too complicated for the average person to navigate. Whether it's related to insurance type, what conditions are and aren't covered, needing to meet certain eligibility criteria, finding and getting to the specific service that's needed, the only way we will be able to optimize access to needed services is by unwinding the convoluted ball of yarn that health systems have become through simplification.
Yes.
Yeah, that's a lot. Okay.
That is a lot. But yes.
Don't we think that...
Generally speaking,
do we also think that complexity sometimes is deliberate on some level? Like, sure, things pile up on top of other things and whatever, but it also, like... complexity obscures action pretty successfully.
Yep.
Man, sure. That was dark.
For sure.
Wah, wah. Yeah, no, they did that on purpose. Right. It's a feature, not a bug.
Yeah.
Thank you to everybody who wrote in to the show today, who left us voice memos. We super appreciate it. Yeah. Please keep them coming. I mean, the whole half of the show depends on you, and we love hearing your voices. Also, don't forget to sign up for the Make Me Smart newsletter, marketplace.org/newsletters, for just like more awesome information every week. And we'll be back tomorrow with, speaking of you, contributing to our show. User-generated content, if you will, to throwback, use a throwback term.
Yes.
What do you want to know Wednesday is tomorrow, so we'll have your questions.
How long ago was user-generated content a thing?
I don't know. I don't even know where that came from.
Real quick, one more listener email before we go. It's from Taichi Nakashima, and here's what she had to say. I have a question to help me take my mind off the more serious things going on and to make me just a little bit smarter about Make Me Smart. I heard a snippet of what some of the production team sounds like when I joined the first live stream attempt. Parentheses. Sorry about that. It didn't work so well. Close parentheses. My question is, she goes on, what do the other members of the Make Me Smart squad sound like? This being a podcast, it would help to put a voice to a name. So here's what we're going to do. Every now and then, we're going to have one of the people that actually make this show get on the pod, as it were, as opposed to on the air. They're going to read the end credits so you can hear what they sound like. Today, Eric Phillips. Are we just going to sit here now and listen? I guess so.
Yeah. This is so weird.
All right. It is weird.
Make Me Smart is produced and directed by Sam Anderson. Our digital producer is Tony Wagner, and our senior producer is Jody Becker. Ben Hethcote is our video producer, and our video intern is Ethan Peretz, and I am Erica Phillips. I write our newsletter and smart speaker skills. You should sign up for our newsletter. Today's program was engineered by Drew Jostad and mixed by Garrett Lang. Our theme music was composed by Ben Tolliday and Daniel Ramirez. Our executive director of On Demand is Satara Nieves. And our senior vice president and general manager is Deborah Clark.
It's a hard job.
Thanks for listening.
Oh, my God.
That was awesome. That was great. That was awesome. That was really, really cool.
This is great. Really we could just keep doing this and just outsource the whole back half of the show. Listeners. No joke. Producers. Oh, great job, Erica. Great job.
Well done. Well done.